what has happened is that in fMRI, you used to have hot spots. Do you remember the God spot here in the temporal lobe? That's where God is. But in fact, nobody really talks about spots now. The whole thing has gone into networks. So it's networks of systems, and it's the relationship between parts. So neuroscience is changing in a very subtle way. And with this change has gone the idea that you can educate the brain in a way that one didn't think was possible before, and that function can be transmitted between different areas. And as I've mentioned before in conferences, there are examples where the cortex of the blind, the visual cortex of the blind, in fact feels and doesn't see. So they really take over other activities in a very dramatic way. So Valeria was born in Parma. Lovely Italian upbringing. I rather envy that, actually. And Valeria is a rock climber. And she has always been interested in people, and also in science and biology. And so she has worked with a number of techniques, one of which is indwelling electrodes. But more recently, after a rock climbing holiday, she met one of the people from the main labs in Italy, and she's now joined them and has been working with fMRI and transcranial magnetic stimulation. Transcranial magnetic stimulation is when you put a very strong magnetic field and it goes through the scalp and stimulates the brain underneath. And there's a lot of new information coming from that technique. So Valeria has been looking at mirror neurons, and she very much hopes to continue with this work. So we're very lucky to have her here today to give us a really authoritarian account of mirror neurons, what they are and what they do. So Valeria, please, everybody welcome Valeria. And it's mirror neurons, the role of the motor and somatosensory system in social perception.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody, and the organizer of the conference for having invited me. Because this conference to me, it was really, really a learning experience and very enriching. I mean, my scientific career, it's pretty short compared to all the other speakers. So, and I really took a lot of insights. I don't know. So now I hope to, now with my talk, to share with you the thoughts that have been growing also within these 2 days. So my talk has been changed all the time in these couple of hours based on what I've heard. So, and in my short career, though, I've been listening to many talks, and I was puzzled by the fact that as soon as one of the speakers became a father or a mother, they would start using pictures or movies from their child, right? And I, at that point, I wasn't a mom, so I thought, what's this necessary? Is this necessary? I mean, it's nice, okay, but why this urge, right? And now that I'm a mom, I can really share this urge. So I will start with a movie of my daughter. I still don't know why we keep using them, but so let's see. So, I'm glad to see you happy in a way. Because what I want to stretch again, once more, that when we observe somebody else's action, we immediately feel in ourselves not only the action, the sensation as well, the emotion. So we, in a way, share their happiness and maybe her pride, because we could see that she was also proud of learning to walk. And when she you know, she was starting, and we could feel in our body a little bit of this insecurity, right? And I think that if you, I don't know if you have a newborn in your family, or if you just got a surgery in your hip, maybe, these are factors that would enhance even more this sharing, because, I mean, if you're just recovering from your surgery, you already struggle yourself, and seeing somebody else struggling would make you even more feeling that sensation. So, but how does it happen? I mean, how come do we feel this? We don't have any insight into our body, in a way. We don't see what's happening in our body. We don't see what's happening in our mind. We only see muscles that shape the skin of the face in a smile, and we feel happy, right? So how does our brain make us sharing these actions, sensations, and emotions of other people? So I will start from the very beginning. So we believe, in a way, that mirror neurons, and you've heard about them in the previous talks, could be the basis of this spontaneous sharing. And most of you already know what they are, but I want to refresh your memory, and I will show you what they are. So here I will show you two small video clips. In the first one, you will hear the response of a neuron while the monkey is acting herself. So the monkey will grasp a piece of food, and then you will hear the discharge of a neuron. So we record with an electrode, and we transform this signal into a sound. Was it clear? You heard this discharge? That was the neuron discharging when the monkey was grasping. So now, in the next movie, you will see again the monkey grasping, but then you will see the experimenter grasping. And the monkey was observing the experimenter grasping. And then you will hear again the discharge of the neuron. The other way. The monkey. And now Leo. Leo is grasping again. So the first definition of these neurons are neurons that were found in the premotor cortex. I will come back to that in a second. That discharge both when the monkey acts and when the monkey sees and observes somebody else performing the same action. So it is important that has been found in the premotor cortex, because that area was at that point thought only to take care of our action, to program our own action. So it was really surprising that they found it active also when the monkey would observe and not act. So at that point, all the research involved in this research were really enthusiastic, and they thought, okay, this can really be a way to have a spontaneous understanding of the other people, because basically what happens if we transform what we see in our own inner representation of that action. But I mean, you saw that Leonardo was grasping with the hand or towards the mouth. So we could say if that neuron discharges all over whenever we act, or independently of the action we do, then it's not so informative. So it cannot really translate a lot, as only just the fact that we are acting. So the neuron needs to be specific to convey a message. So they presented the monkey with two actions, breaking the peanut and a squeaking duck. And then they recorded from a neuron, and this neuron, while watching the action, was preferring the peanut to the squeaking duck. So here is when the action happened, and you can see here that there is a bigger green than the amount of red here. It doesn't matter what it is now, but it's the amount of response. So you can definitely see that here we have more response than in this case. And this was true not only when the monkey was observing the complete action, but also when the monkey was presented with only the vision of breaking the peanut or squeezing the duck without the sound, just miming the action. And this was also true when the monkey was presented just with the sound of the action, so without having the opportunity to see what was going on. Again, we have a preference for the peanut breaking than the squeaking. And that was also true while the monkey was performing the action itself. So there is a selectivity. So this neuron was conveying the message, okay, there is somebody breaking the peanut. And maybe this neuron was specifically hungry, I don't know, but nevertheless, it was specific. And this selectivity was across many modalities. So now we can change a little bit the previous statement and say that we translate specifically, in a way, the observed action into in our own representation of that action. And it can be specific in many ways, but I will not go into that at this point. So, now we are happy because we found a nice way to translate the actions of other into the monkey way, the monkey brain, right? All this happened in monkeys. So we are happy for the monkey because they can understand us, we can say. But we would be probably even happier if we would show that this system or these neurons are also present in humans. Because it would be nice to speculate about it. And so how do we study these neurons in humans? So nowadays, there is the proof that they do exist in humans. There are people that recorded from human brains, and they did show that they exist. So there is no doubt anymore. But the usual way to study them, it's not by putting electrodes in the human brain. It's like, you can see how difficult it could be to find subjects, right? So we normally use the MRI scanner. And I know that most of you will know what it is, but just briefly, I show you one. And normally we put people in here, they just lay down, and then we ask them to do a task. And we can then have a picture of the brain, but not only. We can image the areas that are active during a specific task. And here you have an example. So they just lay down people there, and they do something, and then we picture the brain. And what we normally use as a task is action observation and action execution, the same things that we used in monkey. So we use movies like this, so just a everyday life kind of action, that we compare with movies like this, just to be a bit more selective, because otherwise we are again in this issue, do they respond to everything or not? And what we do next, sorry, I was clicking too much, we picture what happens in the brain while people observe these actions. Well, when they observe this action, and these are the activity that is more for this action than for this. It's a specificity. And these are the areas that are active during observation. And then we ask our subjects to perform actions in the scanner themselves. So they do exactly the same. And then we compare them again with another action to look into the specificity issue. And here you see a map of the areas that are active more when the people act or do that specific action. You can already see how similar these two brain or this set of activations look like. And if we indeed compare them directly, let's like intersect them in a way, then we see that these areas are active both during the observation and the execution of a similar action. But these are areas, these are not neurons, because we don't have the resolution of neurons with this technique, okay? And so that's why we couldn't say for a long time, we couldn't really prove that these neurons exist in humans, but that some areas act similarly. But now we do have the proof. And if we look at these areas, we can also, and we compare them with the ones that have been found in the monkey, so this is the human brain and this is the monkey brain, then we see that we find the same areas, basically, where they found the mirror neurons. So we have premotor areas, where they originally have been discovered, and then we have another area here that corresponds to this. I will not really enter into this issue, just to show you the similarities. The similarities and the differences, because here, well, differences. Well, they do also find them. But anyway, we found another area. It's a somatosensory area. So I told you before that the premotor was originally thought to take care of our actions. Well, the somatosensory areas is thought to take care of our sensation, either tactile or proprioceptive, so what we perceive from our muscle, the posture and stuff. So I found it very interesting because I thought, okay, now I see why we also really perceive the action, not just understand the action when I see somebody else. I have the feeling of what it means like to lift a book, right? And I get this idea of the weight of the book, for instance. So we can say, well, that's nice, we have these areas and we can understand the action of other people, but how can we really know that each of these areas is really contributing to our perception of the other's actions? We just see that they are active, right? So we came up with a way to test this. And to test this, we used the transcranial magnetic technique that, I didn't see you anymore, that you were describing before. So you have a small magnetic field, much smaller than the one we use in the bigger machine. And this elicits a current that is quite localized. And you can use this either to excite the cortex or to inhibit the activity of the cortex. And we decided to use the inhibitory effect to study the causality or how much this area contributes to our perception of action. And you need, of course, to compare to measure something. And if you just stimulate, you measure nothing. And so we need a task. And then we run the task before stimulating and after stimulation. And then we measure how the task performance changes. So we have this set of areas, and we want to know if these areas really contribute to action understanding. So if we disrupt or inhibit the activity of the premotor cortex, for instance, then we could think that this action understanding would be impaired somehow. And this we will measure this action impairment by measuring decrease in performance. And the same could be true if we would apply TMS on the somatosensory cortex, because again, if we believe that the somatosensory cortex contributes actively to our action understanding, then if we inhibit it, then we would have again an impairment of action understanding and a decrease in subject performance. So we had this task. We showed movies like this, and then we asked to our subjects to say how heavy this bottle was from 1 to 5. And then we showed movies like this. Which one was the heaviest, by the way? So you see that you can really perceive the weight. But again, you don't have a lot of information about the weight there, not directly. And then to control, again, for specificity, we run a task like this. So how heavy is the ball from 1 to 5? Or which one is the... Oh, sorry. Anyway, my computer slowed down a bit. It was heavier anyway. And so just to see whether it is about weight in general or if there is something specific to human action, right? So what we asked them, our subjects to do was to run this task before stimulation or better, while they had the belief to receive a stimulation, but they never received it. So that's what we call sham, because that's the best control we can have. And then we also run the task after stimulation. And here you see the performance, and you can see that indeed there was a decrease in performance when their somatosensory cortex was inhibited. I forgot to say that in the first experiment, we indeed inhibit the somatosensory cortex. So we had inhibition that lasted for about 35 minutes, and they ran the task, and during this inhibition, the performance was lower than without the inhibition. And if we would do the same with the ball, then there was no significant effect. And again, as all the techniques, there are some limitations. So this could definitely also be due to the fact that we didn't stimulate exactly on the right spot, or could be an effect so that it flows in from adjacent areas. So we also try to run the same paradigm and the same things to an area that is slightly behind and in the back, and there was no significant effect, and an area that is slightly in front, and there was, again, no significant effect. So it really looks like that when we inhibit or interfere, to be more correct, with the activity of the somatosensory cortex, we have a task impairment. And we can probably conclude, that The primary somatosensory is contributing to our action, our action perception, and probably with information or of how it feels like. And if we stimulate adjacent area, we don't have an effect. And somebody else did the same experiment on the premotor cortex, and they found exact same results. Actually, it was the opposite. They did the experiment first, and then we copied them. But it doesn't really matter. So both the somatosensory cortex and the premotor cortex seems to play a causal role in this spontaneous understanding of sharing. Okay, we know that they play this role, but what do they do? I mean, they are important, but what they are really doing, what's happening? So we don't really have yet a clear answer about that, but I will try to, again, to show you how we try to study it, the bit of knowledge that we now have. And to do that, what I want to do is ask you to split like this half. We close the eyes when I tell you to do so. And this half, we keep the eyes open, right? Okay. And then I will tell you when to open them, so don't worry. It's going to be very short. Please close your eyes. Okay, now you can open them again. And I'm going to ask to one of you what you think I've done. How do you think I've done it? Can you mime it? Was it true?
No.
Why? Because I didn't, I mean, I did, but you can see, this is the paper, so you were right in a way. But I didn't do it with like this. I just used my mouth. So what does it mean? It means that probably what we do is that we use our knowledge, previous knowledge, to share and to understand what's happening to others. And we investigated these in a more scientific way. So we presented, again, our subjects within the scanner. Instead of with movies, we presented them with sounds, like this one. Don't laugh, I'm doing that. Or this one. So we divided them in two categories, like mouth sounds and hand sounds. We had much more sounds, but it's just an example. And we asked them to listen to these sounds and then to perform, again, the very similar action in the scanner. So they rip the paper, for instance, and they break the peanut and stuff like this. And here what you see is when we try to map the mirror neuron system or these shared circuits or what, however you want to call them, I'm not so affectionate to a term, right? I just see that they share something in common. I map the system for the mouth, so where I look for areas that are active both during listening to mouth sounds and performing mouth action, and that's what you see here in blue. And then I mapped basically areas that are active both when you hear the hand sound and you perform a hand action. And here you really see that, again, the hand location here prefers, during the experience, the execution, prefers hand actions to mouth actions, and the same during the sound, and it's true also during vision. And here you have this blob that prefers mouth compared to hand, both in observation and experience. And this is just to say that whenever the sound doesn't really carry any information about the effector you use. It's just sound waves reaching your ear, right? So whenever we hear that sound, we spontaneously activate or map it in our own representation of how we would do that specific action with our hands or with our mouth. So there is a more striking example of what I'm saying now. And this is people that are born without arms, right? Because how can you map hand actions if you never had a hand before, never used it? I'm saying that we use what we know to understand the others, but what happens if we don't know what they have? So they behave normally. They didn't have any. One was a computer programmer, so they just used their feet instead. So they know they're familiar with all the actions we do, but instead of doing them with their hands that they don't have, they do them with their feet. So they shake your hands. Ah, nice to meet you with the foot. It's really amazing what they can do. And luckily, we had the opportunity to scan two of them, and we make them observe again these movies of hand actions are the same, exact same movies as I shown before. And we asked them to perform actions in the scanner. Of course, not the hand actions, but foot and mouth. And then again, we mapped their mirror activity. Here, you can see them, the two of them, and the normal control, well, normal developing control group. Can you guess who, can you recognize the two aplasia? So, one idea could be that they activate the system less because they don't have these effectors. So then we could pick two, maybe this guy or maybe this guy, but actually not. These two are the aplasic subjects. So they really fit within the normal population. Exactly the same. And why? How? It's simply because they are indeed mapping what they observe in their own way to do that action. They exactly know what it means to drink and to take a glass because they do it every day, but just they do it with their feet. And indeed, they map the hand action into their own representation of foot and mouth actions. So we need, in a way, we use our experience to interpret the others. Here there is another important point. If we compare these two brains, this is the brain of the agent while it's performing an action, and this is the brain of the observer while observing the action. And we have seen that, or we can observe that they are really, really similar to each other. So it is about mind reading or it is about projection? Okay, we tried to answer this question by showing again this usual new movies, probably you're going to hate them at one point. And here again, it's what the mirror neurons activity. And here we show this time movies of a robot, industrial robot, performing the same action. Right? And the action is the same. And here the activity is also the same of the one we observe when we observe a real agent performing the action. There is no difference between these two when you even compare them directly. But in one case, this is the mind of the agent, and this is the mind of the agent. So there is, in one case, a match. So we could be led to think, oh, this is a nice mind reading because of the similarities. But here there is a big mismatch. So we can't really do mind reading here, right? So I would be tend to say it's more about projection. And this mind reading comes from the fact that this projection happens to be very similar to the reality. But it is about putting yourself into others' shoes somehow. Or projecting what you feel, what you act into the other. And I've been talking of experience already. And experience means that, in a way, or suggests that we can learn, right? We can, because we can change, we can acquire new experience. And indeed, this system is moderated by learning. There was a study, oh, I don't remember now the name, I apologize for that, but they basically put the subjects in the scanner and they made them listen to a small sequence of notes, like a small melody. And then the activity was mainly focused on the auditory cortex. But then they taught the subjects the sequence. They really, these subjects learned for 5 hours, not more, to play that sequence. And after that learning session, they also activated all the premotor, the somatosensory cortices, and so on. So we can really train the system. And that's why the system is plastic, and we learn how to use our mobile phone. And if we see somebody doing this, we know exactly what it means and what it's doing. And there are also other type of modulators, like inter-individual differences. We all go to a movies. And nevertheless, although we can maybe all enjoy the same movies, it's not that we enjoy it at the same time or at the same moment or in the same way. Sometimes people cry to a particular scene and others don't. So we decided to try to measure those differences, and one way of doing that is to try to measure how much you put your capability to put yourself in others' shoes. And this is done by giving subjects a questionnaire, and subjects were asking to give a number from 0 to 4 to a list of sentences, like, when I'm upset at someone, I usually try to put myself in his shoes for a while. And then you would give 0 if this sentence doesn't describe you well, and 4 if it really describes you very well. So who would say, I give 0 or 1 or 2? And who would say 4 or 3? Okay, keep this in mind. And then there are more questions here, but I will not go through all of them. And here, what I've done, here we see again a mirror neural system activity. This comes from the sound experiment. And here are the values from our subjects. And what we did then, we split them in two groups. We took the 6 with the highest, the one that rated with the highest value in the scale, and we plotted their mirror neural system. And you see that they activated a lot. And now we plotted the 6 with the 0, 1, or 2, and this is your brain. Well, I just show you before that everybody has a mirror neural system, because in that slide, with all the brains, all the subjects had a mirror system. But in that case, the information was really complete. It was a visual mirror system, so there was nothing to fill in. I mean, it was really clear what was going on. So probably in that context, everybody spontaneously activated the mirror neural system, and maybe the factors that influence the amount of activity there are a bit different, or I don't know. But in cases of the sound, for instance, when information is not conveyed completely, then inter-individual differences could really play a major role. And it doesn't mean that these people do not activate the mirror system at all, or they are not able to. That's another thing. It's just that they would not do it as much spontaneously. And here, just another way to represent the correlation. So all the 3 important nodes of the mirror neural system correlate with perspective taking, really putting yourself in other shoes. Okay, I hope I gave you a nice idea about actions, the fact that we indeed simulate or project ourselves in what we observe into others, and we really share kind of the action, what it feels like even. And this, I consider this like a small stone, not really a conclusive system or the system that solves all the problem or explains everything. Just one, something that helps your brain or you to put yourself into other shoes. So if it is true that it's a mechanism, why wouldn't it be present also in other domains, like touch or emotions? And here you see another couple of experiments which do show that indeed a very similar mechanism exists also for more tactile sensations and for emotions. So what we did here was to, I don't have the movies, I apologize for that, but I changed my computer and they don't run on this, don't know why. But here we showed movies of legs being touched by a rod, so the rod was really going on top, and we compared it with another movies where the rod was simply moving beside, so there was no touch involved, but the movement was the same and everything else was the same. And then we make them experience the same touch, so we had a very high-tech device, so we were entering in the scanner with a washing glove and simply move the glove up and down on the legs. In this way, here we could map the areas that are active during the observation of others' touch, and here the areas that are active while you experience the touch. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, these are somatosensory areas, so it makes also sense, but the main concept, again, is that when you try to combine these two, there is an overlap. So there are parts of our brain that are active, again, both when you experience some touch and when you observe somebody else receiving the touch. So again, it's a sort of spontaneous response. And here, I want to simply say a word about laterality, because yesterday it was also a topic. It is a bilateral system in our case. We didn't find ever in any significant difference between the two hemispheres. What we noticed is that in one of the hemispheres, the location was more variable than in another. It doesn't mean that they do exactly the same things, the two hemispheres, but at least they participate to the sharing. And here again, we wanted to see whether this was specific for human being or not. So we had movies where we touch kind of toilet paper or carpet or other things. And we saw basically that also for this case, we have activation of the system. So we do have a feeling of what it feels like being touched, also when it applies to not human beings. And that's, to me, I interpret this as a sort of, that's why we anthropomorphize also so much, because of all this projection and this capability to feel, then we can really easily, I don't know, share emotions with our pet or our doll or when you're a child, and that might be a way to learn or to keep the system flexible. Emotions. Yes, it happens for emotions too. So when we see others, we do share the emotions of other people because we do activate the areas that we would use to feel those emotions ourselves. And in this experiment, what we did, I was just a subject there, and I can guarantee you that the experience was interesting. So we showed movies of somebody drinking from a glass, and they could be neutral, like taking the glass, drinking, and putting back. Or it could be, let's say, disgusted. So like taking the glass, like this. Or drinking from a pleasant wine, like, and then go back. And then in the scanner, they made me experience the same. So, but instead of wine, they gave me like strawberry or minty taste, like flavored with just odorants. And then he also sent me like butyric acid, that is really like erased butter, or rotten eggs kind of smell. So it was quite disgusting. I survived, but one subject had to be taken away because it was starting vomiting. So it was really... And again, here what you see is the part of the brain that are active when you feel disgusted yourself. And here the parts of the brain that are active when you observe somebody else being disgusted. And again, there is an overlap. And if we lesion this part of the brain, well, there are people that had lesion there, not because we caused them, fortunately, but... You could observe that this part of the brain was really important for you to really perceive the disgust, because these subjects could really eat like a cake that has been in the fridge for 3 weeks or make it with these cockroaches on top, and they say, oh, delicious, this kind of stuff. And this part or lesion in these areas would also lead in deficit in your perception of detecting disgust. In figures or in pictures from other people being disgusted. So it is, again, important. It is playing a causal role, again, in this sharing of the emotions. But it's not just about disgust. It's also about pain. It happens exactly the same. And the area is actually very much the same, too. And it also happens for positive emotions. So it's not just about negative, also about positive. And indeed, it's very hard to find differences between emotions. So I would be curious to talk maybe later on about that. If you try to isolate what's the area for pleasantness and what's the areas for a negative emotion, you will have a really hard time to find an area that prefers one of the other emotions. So either they're really interconnected, or we cannot have the resolution, and indeed there are neurons that prefer one and the other in the same area. or it is about arousal, or about other things. I don't know personally. But these works also, not when you just read a story. So most of us can feel these things while reading a book. And if you try to read these, I think I let you read it because your English is much better than mine. And I think you will have a quite disgusted kind of reaction. And it... So it's exactly the same. The modality doesn't matter. It enters into your brain. But again, do we always share emotions? The answer is maybe, maybe not. I think there are here as well inter-individual differences or differences that come from culture or experience and all these factors. And one example was given by Tanya again, where she basically had the participants play a game with either a fair or an unfair player. And the participants were either female or male. So she had two groups, female playing with a fair and unfair, and male playing with a fair and unfair. And here what you see is that for female, they activate this system, so they share when they observe the other receiving pain, because that's what she also showed. So they made the game, and then she showed this fair and unfair mate receiving pain. So female do share the pain for both the fair and unfair player, although a bit more for the fair player, but male actually did not share. I let you speculate about it. And another factor is the in-group, out-group. This is quite interesting as well. So they had two groups of people, white people and black people. And then they showed pictures of hands being with a needle penetrating the skin or not. And they showed pictures from the in-group, but also they observed pictures from the out-group people. And here they didn't use the magnetic resonance, they used TMS, but not in the inhibitory effect, but with the excitatory effect. So basically, if you put, you stimulate your motor cortex, you observe like a twist in your finger, for instance, and then you can measure how much these muscles was really active and how much was twisted. And normally, when you observe the actions of other people, the amplitude is reduced. And this shows you that there is an interference between the observation and the experience, right? So they are tightly connected to each other. And here what they found is that this recording is reduced only when they see somebody from the same group receiving pain and not when somebody else is receiving pain. And this is true independently of the group you're in. So it was the same for them. They had reduction to this and not to this. So this is quite striking, because that would, if you could, you could interpret it also in the wrong way, I would say. But intuitively, we do have a preference sharing from people that are more similar to ourselves. And this indeed correlated also with how much these people were racist, thank you, sorry, or they felt belonging to a particular group. And I will come back to that, because I don't want you to take the wrong conclusion at all. And then other differences here, they had a sport fan, and they had two teams, and then they had the fan from team A and the fan from team B. And then they made them observe the people from the other team, the other fan team, to receive pain again. And again, what happens is that you feel more empathy, or you activate more your shared circuits when you see people from the same group again. So if you are a fan of team A again, and another friend of you is receiving pain, you feel more, you activate the system more than if you see somebody that is a fan of another team. So it applies also for a less defined kind of group. So we can modulate this system. And we think that empathy has something to do with it. And we showed you that your capability to put yourself in other shoes is also related to that. So what a better model than finding people that lack this empathic response, or they don't care about other people so much. So we try to investigate what happens in psychopaths. I'm not an expert on this, so I run the experiment because of my question, right, about mirror neurons and shared circuits and stuff. So I'm not an expert in psychopathy, but what I know is what you know as well. They do not care about inflicting pain to other people. And if it's true that vicarious activation, these shared circuits, are a foundation for taking care or for feeling empathy or these things, then you would kind of hypothesize that these people might lack of this, or that this system would be less active. So we managed to collect 18 patients from a clinic in Holland, and they came into the scanner, and then they saw this moving, for instance, and then, it escaped the exclusion. Let's see if I manage again. Okay, I do it in another way. This is another sort of inflicting pain, but it's more subtle. It's not really physical pain. It's social pain, what we call. And then they saw this. They looking for attention. And then they saw pleasant stimulus like this. And then in the scanner, we made them... Wait. Sorry. In the scanner, we made them feel exactly the same. We really hit them. We exclude them. So we ask them to lift their hand, and then we push them away. And then we shake their hands, and then we caress them. And again, we map their system. Like here, what you see, this is the control group, and this is the mirror neuron system for the control group. So the areas that are active both when they observed all these video clips and felt all these emotions. And this is the system for the psychopath. So we could conclude from here that they do activate the regions, the shared circuits less. But we have to see first, because this is the difference, and this is... So there were no difference in experiences, all these emotions. So then we created one mask to really map for common areas to observation and execution. And these are the areas that are left. So these are really the areas that are active both when you observe and you feel. And these are the areas that are more active for the controls than for the psychopath. So this is the sharing system that is more active for controls. And there was nothing more active for psychopath. And the areas that we found were, again, the same areas involved in actions, here premotor, in sensations, primary, secondary, somatosensory, and emotional areas, emotional sharing. But this is not the complete story. Because it is true that they have a reduced somatosensory and premotor and emotional sharing. But there is a difference between not spontaneously sharing and the capability of doing so. And we've heard it also before in the previous talk. And so we show them again the movies, specifically the one showing the pain and the one showing the love. And then we ask them this time to actively empathize with one of the two hands, like the receiver or the one that inflicts the pain. And in this case, these differences basically went away. So when asked to do so, they are able to. That was quite interesting. So this could be also, hopefully, of use for therapy, because then we could try to train them in actively looking at the, maybe... I think it's much more complex than this, the entire story of psychopathy, but this can be just one additional factor. So we can, in a way, conclude that it there is really this difference between the capability and the tendency to do it, to do so spontaneously. Like we have seen for the empathy before with the sound. I mean, when the information is not complete, then we have more or less a spontaneous reaction to it, and it's inter-individual differences. So I'm almost at the conclusion. How am I doing with the time? Well?
Yes, you've got 4 minutes.
Ah, that's plenty. And I will try to summarize what I've been showing to you now and to also share some of my thoughts, the one I had in these couple of hours. So when we observe somebody else acting, like this is the observer, this is the action, right? This is his brain, so we have the external stimulus entering the brain towards the eyes and the visual cortex and reaching these areas that take care of action, sensation, and emotion, so eliciting this spontaneous response to others' actions. And this basically forms our inner representation of that action, right? We can put it together with our experience or so, and in turn, we could say, okay, we tend to project the other, to understand the others by projecting ourselves into the others. But so in this case, Chris would project himself in Mario, which is a much older man with a completely different experience. He's a vet and he's a scientist. And then he would project himself in Julia, which is 1 year old baby. We can see that how Chris's memories of how he was when he was a child might not be so precise. So if we just rely on this areas or these circuits or this spontaneous reaction, our perception would not be so accurate. I mean, it could really drive a good behavior just a good reaction, but it wouldn't be perfect. So for that, we need to down-regulate or to have another system or a reflective system that interacts with this other, and it happens to be in the front kind of part of the brain, the most recent part of the brain. And these two is the interaction between these two systems that will help us to make a more accurate perception of the other. So when Mario would stay Mario, although we would share maybe his joy in playing with Julia, but still we would understand that Mario is not me. And the same here. And then we can finally decide how to act, right, in a more appropriate way. So here we have this, what I like to call pre-reflection sharing of action, sensation, and emotion, which I would maybe call spontaneous empathy more than sympathy, but it has also something to do with sympathy. So I want to say that this empathy, what I'm calling empathy here, it's something more spontaneous. It's not so conscious yet. And then we have this reflective state, and they do interact. And then you have all these internal and external factors that modulate either each state, each part individually, or the interaction. And it's the in-out group, the experience, the attention, the empathy, your capability to introspect, which is, I think, very important as well. And then again, we have after the result of all this interaction and stuff can really help you in a better perception and decision making, more deliberate empathy. Really decide, okay, now I'm going to put myself into your shoes, I'm going to help you, or I'm going to be compassionate, or what you think it's more appropriate at that moment. And so then we can act. And psychopathy, we've seen that they seems to have a problem here, but maybe the problem is not just that they don't have the system, but they simply they are not using it spontaneously. So we have to make to be, we have to be attentive how we interpret and how we conclude things. I have to say, and here I have to say that to me this system, I would say, it makes this golden rule very intuitive. Okay, why? It's so clear to me that I don't want to do something I don't want to receive. I mean, I don't want the other to do to me, or I tend to do what the other, I think they will like to receive, or something like that. It's just intuitive, because it could generate a little bit there already. That's I'm sharing, right? So that's why I don't want to hurt you. But it's not there. It's not just there. I think the real golden rule stays here at the end, when all the system has interacted and we can reflect upon it, and all the factors come in. So then it becomes conscious and we can deliberately do something, hopefully for the good. So all the other speakers have been kind of advertising books and writing books, but I didn't write any book yet. And I'm not sure I will ever. But applying the golden rule in a positive way, if I were to write a book, I of course would like to have a friend advertising for my book. So that's what I'm doing. So if you want to read something about our work, there is this nice book and for all of you to read. And it's really about our research and our interpretations of the results. And now I want to thank first all of you, because I really enjoyed this audience. You're very active and I don't know, it was really pleasant to talk to you and all my collaborators, of course. Alessio Venanti from Cesena, from Rome, actually, and that helped with the TMS, introducing me with the TMS, and Nicola, a PhD of mine that actually collected most of the data on the TMS, and Sara also, it's another PhD student that helped, Arma that did most of the work on psychopathy. She really went to the clinic and looked for them, and that's the disadvantage of not having learned Dutch yet. And and of course, I can't forget Bruno Vicaire that introduced me in the fMRI world and helped with the smell, with the disgust experiment. Lisa that participated in the sound experiment. And of course, Vittorio Gallese and Giacomo Rizzolatti for having introduced me to mirror neurons. And final, but the most important person, I would say, Christian Kieser, which is my mentor, friend, colleague, and companion of life. Thank you all.
Thank you very much, Valeria. That's absolutely wonderful. And I loved your scientific caution. Maybe people can learn. And I thought that was just a wonderful caveat, particularly in terms of the psychopathy. So let's go into the questions. And we have a right-left brain question.
You might not.
Ian.
Valeria, first of all, I want to thank you for a beautiful, elegant, and genuinely fascinating talk. Thank you very much. I have a number of observations. I'll just make a few brief ones. I was interested in the findings with your people with limb aplasia. You probably know a study that Ramachandran did with gesticulation and speech, and found that actually when we speak, we automatically make hand and finger gestures in the brain, even if we're not actually making them with our arms and hands. But he also found that people who were born limbless did this as well. And I wondered whether you had any observations on that. I'm just going to make a couple of it, and then you can... Another was about the automatic hand. You probably also know work which shows that when people observe the outcomes of actions which they believe are made by humans, they find their bodies are moving in sympathy and their minds are reacting to this. But when they know it's a machine, they don't. And that children will imitate humans, but they won't imitate a machine doing the same action. I've also wondered if... I saw you said you commented on laterality. I'd need to look at those scans with you. Yeah. But it looked to me as though there were actually differences. And I noticed that you quote, obviously, Dossetti, Jean Dossetti, a very important research in this field. And you probably know Dossetti and Chaminade's work, which suggests they've done repeated work showing that actually our ability to understand and experience pain, emotions, and so on behalf of the other tends to be widely distributed circuits in the right hemisphere. Yeah. Finally, on psychopathy, you probably also know the studies of Damasio and others showing that they have problems in the right ventromedial frontal cortex. Yeah. And I was thinking the right hemisphere is where tends to be more associated with non-socially derived, more spontaneous and less willed emotions, and the left hemisphere with more socially conventionally wish to be expressed emotions. And I wondered if you had any comments on that. So I'm sorry, those are four things.
No. The problem is I don't remember the first one. What was
the first was about the limbless. The second was about
The laterality and
the third was about setting. And the fourth was
So I make a general statement about that would comprise like laterality especially, and it's when I say I don't find differences, it's just because within these sharing circuits, when I tried and I tried to really compare left and right, there was nothing significant. It doesn't mean that there is no a trend. Yeah, and it also doesn't mean that they do the same thing. So I agree with you, and I really like, I actually really liked and enjoyed your talk because it convinced me that they might indeed do something differently. And also you have to take into account that in the images I've been showing here, I always showed the overlap between observation and experience, but it doesn't mean that during the observation we don't find medial prefrontal or other areas. So I just wanted to limit my questions or investigating like within these shared circuits. And then whenever we try to go further, then we do enter in all these issues. So I think they are there. Okay. I don't know a lot about it, so I don't want to really say yes, this is because I don't know, but we do find these areas, and probably I agree with you, they have different purposes. And so it was really about spontaneous. This matching. Diaplasic. Well, I didn't collect any specific scientific information, but indeed, I think when you observe them, you don't have any perception of stranger or something odd because they do really act. They really use the feet as we would use the hand. So I think that this connection could actually be really in their feet. And indeed, when I try to map the location of their activity to end to action, like foot action and mouth action, I notice that these areas that normally are really well separated, in them they go towards the hand region.
Yeah.
Right? So you don't know whether they simply occupy or you still have a sense of hand because some pre-genetically...
No, I wondered if that's what you were
thinking. Yeah. Probably there is a combination of the two, but we can't disentangle that in at this point.
Automated hand.
Yes. This is true. It's definitely true what you said, and a lot of studies didn't find indeed activity to automatic hands. And we have the impression that in these studies often they use the same clip over and over, and with fMRI you often have an habituation effect. So I would probably tend that these studies didn't find it because of that, partly. And it might also depend by the actions we make them do, because this was a very everyday action. And I noticed that there is an interaction, for instance, because that study was much more complex. We also had movies where the hand and the robot were manipulating small wooden shapes, like a cylinder or stuff. And there was, because here I said that there are no differences, but there is a tendency of being more active to the robot than to the robot, than to the human. But in these shapes, there was the opposite kind of effect. Meaning, my interpretation is that when you need to activate your system more when you're not familiar or you don't have the same way of acting, it's like more energetic or demanding because you need to project more or to use more what you have similar. And with experience, you actually have a sort of a reduction in a way, although in other cases you have an enhancement, but it's another kind of experience. But if the robot does something the robot is supposed to do, then we don't need to probably activate so much. I don't know. It's, again, a very tricky part. And there are also effects like, just to say how complex is the issue, this uncanny valley, right? They try to make robots more human-like, but then there is a point, and then there is an increase in... liking these robots and interacting with these robots towards the more they look like humans, okay? But then there is one point where you start to dislike them. So when they look too much you, then you start to be afraid because it becomes an enemy, something you don't. Yeah. So it's a quite complex issue, and I don't have a clear answer. I think we do tend to project even in those cases, but not all the time. And probably it changes with age, because I would say that kids tend to, I don't have a scientific, just an observation, they tend to really project or attribute feelings and states to inanimate objects more than an adult. Mm. So it could be just a mechanism of flexibility of the system, and then you narrow it down to learn what is really human and what is not. So it might. That's maybe why we have this double response.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
My name's Sarah Anderson, very much not a scientist. But I know that Ramachandran did a lot of work with phantom limb pain and mirror boxes. And currently, I've got a very painful left ankle. And my physio has given me this test called graded motor imagery.
Yeah.
So, in case other people don't know what that is, she took hundreds of photographs of both of my feet and put them into 5 sets of 60 plus. And every day I look at all these photographs, and the first 2 weeks it's going left, right, right, left, or whatever. And now I'm on the second stage, which is imagining my foot in the position that it is in the photograph. And then the next stage, which starts next week, I think, is something, I don't know quite what yet, to do with mirrors. Mm-hmm. And this is meant for pain relief. Yeah. And so, I don't know, as a complete layperson, what am I doing? Am I changing how my brain feels?
Be.
Yeah. I think it's not, as I say, an Australian professor who's...
No, but it could very well be that you change some connections between neurons. And unfortunately, I don't have the answer because it's not really clear yet what is this phantom kind of pain. And there are ideas around, but it's not like, okay, we have the answer and we don't know how to cure exactly also this sort of pain. My grandmother also lost the sensitivity of one arm. And sometimes she told me that she thought the arm was in a position and it was in another, or she had a lot of pain. And there was no pharmacological treatment to release her from pain. And I know that a lot of therapists are trying now with imagination, and in some cases works, but not in all. And I think it's because, again, the origin of this pain or the phantom are different between individuals. Like the two aplastic subjects had a completely different perception of their lack of arms. One guy said, oh, it was really easy for me to imagine, or because we also had a task where they had to imagine to do something. It was really easy to me because I didn't have to stop doing it, like stop the motor system to actually act, right? It was easy, it was there and relaxed. And the other said, I simply couldn't do it. I mean, how can you expect me to imagine something I can't do? It was really upset. So the origin, and one guy had really the feeling of having a phantom and the other guy didn't. So it could be, again, at what moment in your life it develops and at what part of the brain or
Your subjects were born without arms.
They were born,
because
yes.
I've only got one arm. I mean, I don't have phantom limb pain, but I do have the feeling of a limb.
Okay.
And it's always in the same position, actually. I mean, that's my feeling. And this is 45 years, so a long time.
And there was no way or occasions where you would stop feeling it? Because I've heard also of people that in some occasion...
Yeah, of course, I only feel it if I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
You know, majority of the time, 99% of the time, I'm not thinking.
Yeah.
But now we're talking about it. Of course, I can feel it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really different. Well,
thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Valeria, over here.
I was fascinated by the fair unfair graph.
Yeah.
Between men and women. And so now I'm putting on my psychologist hat. Many years ago, we used to be told that for healthy emotional development, we had to follow a certain pattern. Mm-hmm. This was the legacy of male thinkers in the psychoanalytic field. And the absolute goal of everybody should be the realization that they were separate.
Yeah.
Okay. Since then, some feminist psychological thinkers have pointed out that to individuate within your gender, the male infant has to realize his separateness from the mother. Uh-huh. And rather than rattle around in a vacuum, he seeks the model of male society so that his individuation can progress in a healthy masculine way. Male society chooses for their stickiness rules and regulations. The female infant has to individuate within the same gender, and so the healthy female development is within a relationship. So female perceives the relationship rather than the rules and regulations. So I was particularly interested in seeing those graphs where the male felt absolutely certain about the fairness and unfairness, and the females were far more concerned, it seemed to me, with the relationship between the two players.
Yes. It is, it's a quite interesting point, to be honest, and I do believe in this fact that we have to take into account that we are the results of years of evolution, and this indeed brought us to be similar and different. And I think that the equality, or when we have to think we are all equal, it is true, and as they were saying, it is true in the sense that we all have the right to be happy and not unhappy in this very deep, profound and unique, maybe, values. But then we, at the external level, we are different, and we should acknowledge these differences and embrace these differences. Because if we try to simply put them aside, then we'll not go anywhere. And that's the same, I said I would go back to the case of the in-group, out-group, and I never actually, now that you mentioned that, it's a similar problem. So we have this tendency, if we have been programmed, maybe because it was necessary at one point, to focus mainly on our group. But now, when the human being has the capacity to go beyond that and to extend these to expand the group. And it's the same with female-male differences. I believe they are, to be honest. I'm a woman in career, and I'm also a mother. I'm happy to be a female. Like, and I don't try to hide that. It's kind of nice, right? And if we try to hide, I have so many friends that try to hide it, and they're simply unhappy. So we have to accept that we are different, and we have to make the best out of it, I think. That was my not scientific kind of response.
I certainly think we'd all agree with that. Now, in order to speed things up a bit, I think it may be helpful if we took a bunch of questions together. And so if you could make your question short, and we'll say have five questions, and then Valeria, you can answer them.
Yes.
If you'd like to.
I have to practice my memory.
First question.
Jeff Taylor. Valeria, thank you for your lecture. I was also interested in the difference between male and female reactivity to the unfair player. And I wondered if there's been any work that's been done comparing those with a hysterical personality versus those with an obsessive personality.
Okay, thank you. Next question. That's hysterical personality. Next one.
Valeria. Hi. Hi. I'm just wondering about desensitization from watching television and films which are traumatic or horrific to watch. I've noticed that I've got a lot more sensitive since I've taken myself away from watching that type of film. And then I may go to friends who say, for goodness sake, it's only a film. But I've noticed, the question is that making us less empathetic and compassionate as a human being if we're watching that type of film all the time that's deadening our sensitivity?
Okay, thank you. That's watching films. Next one.
I want to ask about the...
and your name, very quickly.
Andrea from Switzerland. About the ability to recover or to rekindle this seed. If, for instance, a child has very early deprivation, emotional deprivation, and has not been mirrored and in this way been able to develop that, or also if children, instead of making first-hand experiences like how heavy is plum, how heavy is whatever, but only see it in the two-dimensional TV or video game screen, and they don't actually have this experience to later on assess what they see, and then maybe have the sensory awareness of that. How is it if the children have not developed that? Can they later on, also on the emotional side, develop that? Is there plasticity of this for this, or?
Okay. So development. And the next one?
Rosalind.
Last one.
Okay. With regards to the studies on psychopaths, is it possible by encouraging them to increase deliberate empathy to then feed back and increase spontaneous empathy? And secondly, we've all been encouraged to increase our compassion and empathy. Have any studies been done to see whether that would actually increase the firing of a normal brain with additional compassion training?
Okay, yeah. So psychopaths and training. Right,
yes.
Those
okay.
four. His personality types, hysterical.
Yes, I will combine because, I don't know in the sense that I wasn't the one running this study, and I know that Tanya played with many factors, but I don't think he played with the hysterical factor, but it might be.
There was versus obsessive, sort of the other end of the scale.
Yeah, but I don't know. But I would say it could definitely play a role, and you might modulate that. But I don't have. I don't know if any, if you have, or if any of you has. No.
Okay. Just.
And then.
Seeing
yeah.
films.
And the movies. Yes. Yeah. That's a very interesting question, and that's what I'm planning to do next, by the way. Because it is indeed, we wonder ourselves. So we have this idea that all these violent video games that they play, they are not there to really increase our empathy. And we want to try to see whether this is true or not. So we'll try to show them this. I share the worries, but I don't have an answer yet. And I can say that when we see a movie, we do activate some, there was a nice study of the show that if there was a lot of touch, they would activate more somatosensory in all the people watching at the same time, and then if you would see pain, then all the people would activate, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't show that we are changing or modulating our system. But I really believe in the system to be highly flexible, so I do believe in training in a way, and therefore I believe that all our experiences influences this system, so I'm expecting to find some differences, but I might be completely wrong. And about the children, I can say yes, I believe you can train them to a certain extent. I'm not sure how much. I know, for instance, that a colleague of mine in the lab, that she made a study on autism, and what she found is that there was... So when the autistic people were young, they activated the mirror system less. But with age, they activated more or as much because they received train. So it could be that the train improved the system itself, or it could be that through this more theory of mind or cognitive areas, you manage to compensate. So I think there are a lot of compensatory kind of mechanism
that could really bring you at least to a level of decent kind of sharing, level of sharing. What did I forget?
You didn't really. Psychopaths, if you'd like to do that. But that's the training one.
Yeah, that's the training. I combined the... I hope. That's why I was saying before it would be nice to start a therapy to see whether we can indeed help them to be more attentive and therefore to simulate these feelings. I mean, yesterday meditation afternoon session, there was somebody that indeed said that when he experiences some feelings, then he became more understanding and therefore maybe more compassionate towards the other's feeling. And there is also this saying, I think in English goes like, it needs one to know one, right? I mean, you need sometimes to reach this sharing to really feel what the other is doing, but you have alternative ways to compensate for that, but it might not be exactly the same.
Yeah. Okay, one more question. Who's got the mic?
Could I just say something? This isn't actually a question.
Can you say your name first?
Sue Bayliss, yeah. Okay. About children and learning empathy, because there's a wonderful program called Roots of Empathy, which originated in Canada, has been run in the States, in New Zealand, in Northern Ireland, the Isle of Man, and has just reached Scotland. So any of you that have to do with schools, it's been well researched. It teaches children about their own feelings and developing empathy by bringing in a volunteer mother and a baby. It's a fairly low-cost program, and it's in the research that's been done, the levels of aggression of the children went down and empathic behaviour came up. So it's a wonderful programme. It already exists. It's been well trialled and proven. And the other thing about children is wonderful work by Bruce Perry, who looks at children who've been traumatised by abuse, works out where the deficits in their brains are and works out a whole range of therapies. So if you want to read Bruce Perry, that's very interesting too. So I just wanted to throw that in the pot.
Now it came up to my mind a couple of things. Like, I met at the airport this woman that was working in prisons to help women that have been abused and they would abuse their children later on to change their life. And what they did, what she was doing, was simply trying to teach them love. And once they've learned what it means to be loved, at that point, they were able to love again. So in a way, we really need this experience, and we can train. And I don't know whether it is about these circuits or other factors. That's what I was trying to say before. But there are a lot of examples that show that you really need to teach. And I would also stretch that if we try to teach with the same way, like if we react with aggression to an aggressive person, we simply increase this aggression, because of course the other is understanding that I'm aggressive and that's what he knows. And the only way to really change him is probably to slowly let him know what it means to do something else. And there was about children and TV show, there was another experiment that I was talking about with my husband before, that they showed that they compared Sesame Street with intellectual program, like for kids, like showing how the brain works and this kind of stuff, and they show that basically kids learn more from Sesame Street than from the other one, and it's basically probably because they are able to stimulate emotions and directly they speak the same language of kids in a way, so that makes it easier for them to understand some concepts than simply looking, okay, the brain works even if it's in a nice way like this and this and this.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You must admit that was a really wonderful demonstration, but for me it illustrated two things. First of all, the power of neuroscience. We really are beginning to understand the ways that the brain works, also showing the plasticity of the brain. You won't be surprised to hear that Imperial College have been scanning people and can tell whether they vote Conservative or whether they vote Labour. And there's some really nice work being done. For those of you who would like, you can be permanently out of your body in another part of the room, and you can be trained to do this. Brains can be trained, following neuroscience principles, to do the most wonderful things. Thank you so much, Valeria. That was a stunning talk.